This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I hope you'll let me welcome you and say good afternoon. And like Leonard, this afternoon for me marks the beginning of the 17th year of the Herman P. and Sophia Taubman Endowed Symposia in Jewish Studies. And once again, we can look forward to a series, I think, of exciting and challenging events over the course of this academic year. Every event is successful at multiple dimensions. Thousands of us here in Santa Barbara trek to our various venues on campus and in the community. And hundreds of thousands of people now download Taubman Symposia videos from the University of California's television website. Hundreds and thousands. Leonard keeps track of this. Like, there's one that we have nearly 300,000 hits from. All of this is the result, however, of people who work very hard to provide this program. In large part, this exciting program that we've had for 16 years and we're starting our 17th year is the result of three different kinds of people. First of all, there are the program committee. And it's a unique program committee because it's made up of faculty like myself as well as members of the community. I don't think there's anything like that at UCSB, but we have it with the Taubman. And that allows us to consider very, very interesting people who are academics and non-academics but can speak about important issues related to the Jewish people. The second group of people are there in your program. The list of our donors and all of the people who have given us grants that have allowed us to provide this program. And thirdly, and most importantly perhaps, are the Taubman Symposia trustees who are here today, seated in the front row. And they've just been extraordinary, shepherding us these past 16 years. And I hope there's at least another 16 or more years that we will continue to grow with you. I'd like you to join me in thanking the faculty and our community members who build this program, all of the people in the community who support it, and also the trustees of the Taubman Foundation. Thank you very, very much. It's a great honor now to introduce Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer, who, as you know from the program, is a veteran diplomat, having served as the United States Ambassador to both Egypt and Israel, and who is now the S. Daniel Abraham Professor of Middle Eastern Policy Studies at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. This summer, while my wife and I were in Jerusalem, I decided to ask my friends, many of whom have political careers or they write about politics, if they knew Ambassador Kurtzer. And to a person, all of them said he was the best ambassador that Israel has ever had from the United States. And then, of course, they would say, how is it? And this is the, I'm translating the Hebrew here. How is it that your country gets all of the great ambassadors? In other words, they were thinking that UC Santa Barbara is a country. But I decided to ask them why he was so good, why they rank him as such an extraordinary ambassador. And I want to read you just the comments of two people. First of all, one person told me, Ambassador Kurtzer, and I'm quoting now, was your very best ambassador because he's a great human being, sensitive, wise, and honest. He is a true believer in peace, and more importantly, a true seeker of peace, end quote. Another told me that, quote, Dan was the consummate diplomat during his service in both Egypt and Israel, one who represented the best qualities of a professional U.S. Foreign Service officer, namely that he had a depth of knowledge of the country and the region, balanced views on the Israeli-Arab and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a willingness to articulate forthrightly his government's views, even when many of in the host country might vehemently oppose that position. And he also had the ability to maintain a steadfast focus on both U.S. interests and U.S. responsibilities in that country and region. He was a strategic thinker, and his greatest asset, this Israeli colleague said, was that he's a good listener. We are greatly honored to have Ambassador and Professor Kurtzer with us this afternoon. And at the conclusion, of course, of our discussion with him, he will be signing his new book, Pathways to Peace, America and the Arab-Israeli Conflict, of which we will certainly hear a great deal of today in his talk. Please now join me in welcoming Professor Daniel Kurtzer.
It's almost as though I wrote that introduction. This afternoon is actually very invigorating, and we haven't even begun, because if you come from the East Coast, from Washington, you get infected by what I used to call the Washington consensus. All the naysayers and those who believe that we've tried over many years and have failed to make progress in the peace process, and so why are we continuing to do so? And then to see all of you here for this Taubman Symposium really gives me great hope that there is enough interest on the part of us, the American people, that would bring you out on a Sunday afternoon that really should translate into a greater effort on the part of our government. So thank you all for coming. I want to thank Professor Wallach for both inviting me and also being a terrific host, Professor Hecht, for the introduction. I apologize for limping on the stage. I have a hairline fracture of my, what they call the great toe, occurred yesterday in Boston. And I'm only hoping that at the end of this afternoon, you don't go home regretting that I didn't come with a fractured jaw. So my job is to challenge you and us to think a little bit about not just the Middle East peace process, but a region which is troubled, and a region in which the United States continues to have very significant national interests, very significant value interests, where the choices are not necessarily binary between our values and our strategic interests, but where we are now facing an intersection of at least four major issues that are taking the attention of our senior policymakers and hoping to translate what used to be called challenges into opportunities. So I want to discuss that by widening the lens aperture a bit, not just looking at the Middle East peace process. I want to focus on that at the end of my remarks, but to suggest that what we do in this peace process will be important not just for Israelis and Palestinians, not just for those who affiliate with one or both communities, but it's also going to be critically important for us as a people and for our national interests. And I'm happy to say that we have an administration today, especially a Secretary of State, that seems both interested enough and dedicated enough to try to achieve those purposes of bringing about or stimulating an Arab-Israeli peace settlement. The four issues, of course, are well known to you. Yesterday at a conference in Boston, a former American official suggested that of these four issues, one is a watermelon in size and the other three are walnuts. Iran nuclear is the watermelon. It's a major strategic concern for the United States and for Israel. Some in Israel declare it to be an existential threat, believing that if Iran acquired the capacity to attack Israel, it would become at least a possibility, if not a probability. You have also the chronic conflict called the Syrian Civil War, which not only has engulfed the immediate area of Syria itself, creating now 110,000 casualties, that number goes up every day, but also its spillover effect, the degree to which it has begun to influence the politics of Lebanon and exacerbate the politics of an already weak Iraq, and the possibility of it spilling over also into the occupied Golan Heights and thereby eliciting an Israeli military response. A third issue is the ongoing drama of the Egyptian revolution and the impact that the outcome of that revolution will have on everything else in this region. Let's not fool ourselves. This is potentially one of the great revolutions in history, potentially. Because what the Egyptians have done is to start a process of thinking about who they are, about their identity, about the relationship of various powerful forces within society, the military, the Muslim Brotherhood, so-called liberal forces, about how the society should be organized. Is it still a military-dominated political system, a Praetorian system, as it has been since the 1952 revolution? Or will it be something else? And here we are today in what can only be described as perhaps round five of a 15-round heavyweight bout in Egypt, of an unfolding drama about how Egypt will organize itself and what role it will play in this region. So it's not only interesting as a revolution per se, but it's also interesting and critically important with respect to what the outcome of that revolution is going to mean for Egypt's role in the region. After all, the motivating factor for both Egypt and the United States in the late 1970s of coming together in what became, and still remains to some extent, an important strategic relationship, the motivating factor was to end Egypt's involvement in the Arab-Israeli dispute. You remember, Anwar Sadat, as early as 1972, understood that the Egyptian involvement in this conflict had produced no discernible gains for the Arabs, but had debilitated Egypt's strength militarily, politically, and economically. And so as part of what he hoped would be his own revolution from the top down of changing the nature of Egyptian society, playing with the idea of a competitive party system, opening up the economy, Sadat understood that he needed to change his relationship with Israel. And ultimately, the peace treaty that the United States helped to broker between these two important friends and allies in the region became and remains the cornerstone of whatever we do in the peace process. So the Egyptian revolution is not just interesting as an academic study, and it's not just critically important for Egyptians themselves, but it will tell us a great deal about the direction of Egyptian policy. Will Egypt remain faithful to this treaty? How will Egypt comport itself as the rest of the Arab world, an increasingly dysfunctional Arab state system, looks to an invigorated Egypt for leadership? Will Egypt return to the bad old days of Gamal Abdel Nasser and strike a pose of opposition and radicalism that separates it from a peace process? Or will it use not just its leadership role, but the strength of what we hope will be an Egyptian democracy to help cement a peace process and help its neighbors, Palestinians, Lebanese, and even Syrians, to consummate their own peace accords with Israel? Those were called the walnuts, the insignificant issues, by this former American official. I said to him yesterday that they may not be walnuts. They may, in fact, be peas. But remember the story of the princess and the pea. Princess couldn't rest, no matter how many mattresses you put on that bed, because of the absorbing quality of discomfort of a pea. And so even if today we measure the Iranian nuclear crisis as being at the top of the American diplomatic agenda, we ignore these other issues, in particular the Arab-Israeli, Palestinian-Israeli dimension, at our own peril, because it will become not just the P, but it will become a debilitating factor in our ability, United States' ability, to get our business done in this region. If you look at these set of issues that stand before us, what is striking today about our policy, and I have tended to focus my academic work, as I did throughout my professional career, on us, on the United States. I can't decide for others how to organize their societies or what diplomatic priorities they should assume for themselves. I can help decide what our interests are and how we play those out. So as we think about what it is that we are looking for as a result of what may now be an opening for an agreement with Iran, what may be an opening for a very significant agreement on the removal of chemical weapons from Syria, and on what may be the beginning stages of a Palestinian-Israeli negotiation that may lead to an accord, we have a lot of hard work to do, and much of it begins at home. Why do I say that? In each of these issues, the dynamics and the core factors are no surprises. They're well known to us. This conference in Boston involved an Israeli-American dialogue. We had no difference between us in defining the six or seven core issues on the agenda of what are now the negotiations between the five permanent members of the Security Council in Germany on one side and Iran on the other. Will Iran be permitted to continue processing, enriching uranium? The Iranians say they have the right to do so under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Israelis would like to see no enrichment at all on Iranian soil. The question is, if we can't achieve zero enrichment, at what level will enrichment not become a threat? And there are gradations of either lower enriched uranium or highly enriched uranium, which make a difference in the fabrication of a nuclear weapon. What happens with centrifuges that are currently in play? It's important for us, as we think about the diplomacy of this issue, to think about centrifuges. Not because many of us understand them. I'm sure some people here do. I don't. But because the absence of diplomacy in the last 10 years allowed Iran to go from zero centrifuges to a point where there are enough thousands of centrifuges working where the possibility exists that they can actually fabricate the highly enriched uranium necessary for a bomb. So centrifuges per se are important, but the diplomacy of dealing with this becomes more important. So how many centrifuges will make sense? What do you do with previously clandestine sites in Iran at Fordo or the plutonium processing plant at Iraq? Do they count? What do you do in terms of verification and inspection? Will we know, under the best possible agreement that we can negotiate, will we know in time to do something about it if Iran cheats? In other words, it's not just inspection after the fact or verification after the fact. It's being able to have access to facilities with enough intrusiveness to be confident that you're going to know if the other party to this treaty, to this agreement, cheats on its obligations. So we know the issues. The question is whether or not is going to be a point at which Iranian interests in preserving what it calls its national rights, marked by a high degree of Iranian pride and self-confidence, can be measured off against the security, the real security interests of not just the negotiators, the Security Council members in Germany, but also our friends in Israel, for whom the concerns about Iran are magnified tenfold. We're concerned because of nuclear proliferation. And it's a concern that we've actually done something about in the last 40 or 50 years. John F. Kennedy in 1962 projected that there would be 25 nuclear powers by the end of the last century because he felt the natural progression of national security interests on the part of countries able to master the nuclear cycle, the atomic cycle, would propel them into a nuclear weapons program. He proved wrong, thankfully. He proved wrong because of diplomacy. We pushed back against friends and foes. We didn't have total success. North Korea, India, Pakistan. We didn't have total success with regard to Israel, an undeclared nuclear program, but most likely a nuclear weapons program. But nuclear nonproliferation became a realizable objective for American diplomacy. So as we enter this process with the Iranians, in which we know the issues but don't know the outcome, we have to have some confidence that our policymakers, in consultation with, unfortunately, a very badly divided Congress, will find a meeting point in which the security interests of the United States and our allies, the security interests of Israel, can be preserved while starting on a new beginning with the Iranians. It is not beyond the capability of our diplomacy to achieve that outcome. Now, along the way, we're going to be hearing the ups and downs of what yesterday's news tells us. The Iranians last week put forward a PowerPoint presentation, which apparently was quite interesting. Some will say, well, PowerPoint is PowerPoint. It's the projection of something on a screen, but it doesn't represent anything on the ground. We may hear tomorrow about American ideas for a gradual reduction of sanctions so as to give the Iranians some reason to believe that steps on their part on the nuclear issue will be reciprocated by steps on our part to relieve them of their sanctions problem. And let's not forget that it's largely the sanctions that have driven the Iranians to the table. The election of President Hassan Rouhani in Iran was not a popularity contest. He was the only candidate to articulate what every Iranian knows, and that is the sanctions have been biting, and that the Iranian economy is in deep trouble. And he's the only candidate who was able to both articulate and then to get the space needed from Iran's supreme leader to draw the connection between sanctions relief, which is what the Iranians want for free, and the need to do something on their nuclear program. So there are opportunities here which have not existed in this form for more than 30 years, since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. But this is not the only challenge on our agenda. And if you look at diplomacy and policy as you look at your own businesses and professions, where it's a question of prioritization and time management, and you think about a Secretary of State who's got the entire world to prioritize, and only in the Middle East he has these four critical issues, you can see how challenging this is. And therefore, the opening of a possibility with Syria on chemical weapons is not a problem, it's an opportunity. Now, we can debate, and I'd be happy in the question and answer period if we have different views on this, we can debate whether or not the United States should have intervened militarily to try to decide the outcome of the Syrian civil war. The president, whether you agree with him or do not agree with him, made the determination, apparently both for his own reasons, but also his reading of the American public, which indicated that we do not have the stomach for another, what would look like short-term intervention, but would obviously drag out for many years. You don't get off on the cheap by intervening in the civil war of another country. And so those who argued, well, strategic bombing here and a strategic bombing there and a limited campaign have never been part of a war or war planning. You all know the saying that the best strategic and tactical plans of war get thrown out the window the moment the first shot is fired. And there are extensive quotes from Churchill and others, not a pacifist, was Churchill, to tell you how cognizant he was that war takes on a dynamic of its own. So the president decided in his own mind that there were not sufficient reasons for us to intervene in the Syrian civil war. But he was caught on the horns of a dilemma, partly of his own creation, as we know, because he had established as a red line Syria's use of chemical weapons. And if you establish a red line, the contending party has to believe that you're actually going to do something about it if they violate the red line. And therefore, you had this moment of somewhat incoherence in our policy. The president saying, I have the power to intervene, but I want to know what Congress has to say, knowing quite well that Congress was not going to give him an answer, let alone a decisive answer. And the president having to wrestle with a red line of his own drawing when he really didn't want to act. And so when the Russians came and made this proposal for chemical weapons, and you saw the cynical derision in our press, the Russians are back and the president gave Putin a foothold in the Middle East, why wasn't it seen as a way in which we could exploit an opening to gain something quite important for international non-proliferation efforts? Now, the fact is that had we proposed a chemical weapons removal program in Syria, we would have been laughed out of Damascus. We have no standing in Syria to make such a proposal. So, in fact, the only party that could make such a proposal was the party that, unfortunately, has stuck with the Syrian leadership in the civil war. It's an irony, it's a paradox, it's a conundrum, it's all of those things wrapped up, but that's the reality. And so I don't see this as a problem. I see this as a phenomenal opportunity. It doesn't solve the Syrian civil war. And frankly, we don't have it in our capacity or our will to do so. I shouldn't say we don't have it in our capacity. If we really wanted to, we could intervene and spend a number of years there and probably do in Syria what we did in Iraq. We don't have the will to do that again. Because I don't deny that we have military power that's unparalleled. So let me amend that on capacity and will. We don't have the will to spend 10 years trying to construct a Syrian government that's more to our liking. And I don't think we should. So this chemical weapons opportunity, as hard as it's going to be, made even harder by the fact that the removal of these weapons and the beginning of their destruction will take place in an active war zone. As difficult as that's going to be, this is a tremendous opportunity for us as Americans, for our country, and for a world that believes that there should not be weapons of mass destruction. So that takes us to the third of the four issues that we talked about. I'll say a word a little bit later about Egypt, but it's a different kind of problem given that it's an Egyptian problem. It's not really a diplomatic problem at the moment. And that's the Arab-Israeli issue. In this complex agenda that the administration faces, for reasons that are very interesting, Barack Obama in 2009, and then John Kerry, immediately upon becoming Secretary of State in 2013, defined the Arab-Israeli conflict and its resolution as a vital American national security interest. And if you miss that announcement, listen to what Obama said recently at the United Nations when he gave his annual speech. And he talked about the two goals that he had set for himself over the next few years in the Middle East. They were coming to a fair and secure resolution of the Iranian issue, and they were the Arab-Israeli conflict resolution issue. So this administration, starting in 2009 and now reiterated in the second term, has made this determination. Some of you will agree and some will not. There's a hefty debate, not only in the region, but also in Washington, as I mentioned earlier, by many who say this is a waste of American time and resources. Because again, the time management question for a Secretary of State like a president is to look out over the complete agenda, see what's on his desk, and decide what requires his active involvement in order to try to make a difference. And there are many voices that say that this chronic problem can remain a chronic problem without too much hurt being inflicted on the United States, and therefore we should pay no attention to it, do conflict management, as it's called, hope that the status quo remains essentially static, and do something else. So why has this administration made a different determination? What is it about either the conflict or the prospect of a conflict resolution that has persuaded the President and the Secretary of State to devote significant time from the limited time available to senior policymakers? We heard some of the reasons some years ago from some of our key military leaders. You remember David Petraeus said that as he traveled around the Middle East in his capacity as a senior American military official, he heard a lot about the problems of our bilateral relationship with country X or country Y. He heard about problems of American power or the diminishing of American power, whether American deterrence still had meaning. But he also heard from Arab leaders in private discussions that the inability or unwillingness of the United States to try to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict was hurting the capacity of these countries to work with the United States on the rest of the region's problems. Now, when Petraeus and his successor said this, there were those in Washington and Jerusalem who said, oh, he's a peace processor, as though this is a curse. He's so focused on the Palestinian issue, everything revolves around the Palestinian issue. The reality is, this is what Petraeus heard. Not necessarily because Arab leaders believe that the only problem in this region is the Arab-Israeli conflict. In fact, if you look over, for example, the Egyptian Revolution, the Arab-Israeli issue was not to be found in the Tahrir uprising. But look how soon it reappeared in the national discourse as soon as Mubarak left office, when the Israeli embassy was overrun, when the pipeline carrying Egyptian gas to Israel was attacked 12 times until the Egyptian authorities basically stopped pumping gas into the pipeline. In other words, this issue has resonance in an Arab world that is not only upset because Palestinians, in their view, are suffering under occupation, but also upset because the United States, the power in this region, has done nothing, in their view, to resolve the issue. And Kerry and Obama have understood this in a way that I would suggest many of our other policymakers over the past 15 and 20 years failed to understand. And by failing to understand the impetus for trying to resolve this conflict, our policymakers devoted considerably less attention and manifest considerably less backbone than would have been necessary to actually try to make progress. I was asked earlier, I was fortunate to meet some students from among the student body here, and I have to tell you, even if they're in the audience, they shouldn't listen now because I'm going to say nice things about them. you have some really bright students. Professor Wallach had suggested to me that I open up with a couple of remarks and then see if there was a dialogue. Well, I opened up with a couple of remarks, and then the dialogue took over. The students interacted among themselves in very thoughtful ways. I can't remember why I mentioned this, but it's important to have mentioned it. It'll come back to me in time. The point of this is that if we have determined, as this administration has determined, that the Arab-Israeli peace process is an American national interest, then we have to demonstrate in words and in deeds that we mean it. And here's where the challenge of this peace process comes into play. In many respects, and it's in the book that was mentioned, co-authored two other books where we analyze this as well, in many respects, the solution, the mechanical solution of the Arab-Israeli conflict is about as easy as any solution available to any conflict. What do I mean? We know the issues. Territory. What's going to be the scope of the two-state solution? Where will the borders be? How do you resolve the problem of Jerusalem? Not just the borders, but in particular the conflicting claims that not only overlap, but in many ways are exclusive of one another, especially in the 1 square kilometer area of the Old City, in which holy sites, holy to each of the 3 major Abrahamic religions, exist in proximity to each other. We know security is a major focus. How do Palestinians get a feeling that they can be secure when the Palestinian state is likely to be non-militarized? In other words, it will have capacity for a certain level of self-defense. But Palestinians understand they're not going to have tanks and F-15 aircraft. So what's going to make them feel secure? And how will Israel, a preponderant military power, feel secure when its border with the state of Palestine reverts to maybe a 7 or 8 mile narrow waistline? Looks almost as though Israel is cut in half by that border. So we know security is a major issue. Refugees. There are now registered with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is the agency created in 1949 to deal with Palestinian refugees. There are now about 4.5 million registered refugees. And a registered refugee is anyone who either directly left or was forced from his or her home, or a descendant of someone who left or was forced from his or her home. That number is growing every day. And the Palestinians believe they have a right to return to their homes, not just to a state of Palestine, but to their homes. And since virtually all of those homes are in what would be the state of Israel, even under a full agreement, one could imagine the chaos that would ensue if 4.5 million Palestinians walked into a state in which there were, what now, 7 million Jews. Wouldn't be easy to countenance. So the issue of refugees is critically important, not just in its numbers, but in what I would call one of the underanalyzed aspects of this dispute, which is the issue of narratives. When I teach the Arab-Israeli conflict at Princeton, I start, no matter what the course title is, I start with the issue of narratives. Because one of the most interesting aspects of this conflict is that if you put the narratives of each party up on a blackboard next to each other, they are almost exactly parallel. Almost exactly parallel. A narrative of dispersion and dispossession. A narrative of historical injustice. And I'm letting you fill in the blank of whether I'm talking about Palestinians or Jews. A narrative of anti-ness. Anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish. A narrative of close attachment to a particular homeland. You go through this list, and I have my students develop this list with me. And they usually come out about 8 or 9 in each column. They're almost exactly the same. Which tells you that on the one hand, this could end up being a zero-sum conflict. Because if the narratives don't complement each other and only clash, then either side may feel that it has to win entirely or else its narrative gets impacted. But it also may be a conflict which can be resolved in a manner in which the narratives end up embracing each other. There's a textbook coming out in just a few weeks, co-authored by an Israeli professor who's been at Brandeis for a number of years, an Egyptian journalist think tanker, and a Palestinian pollster. They spent 7 years essentially working through this issue of narratives because they couldn't write a textbook about the Arab-Israeli conflict without having grappled with what every word would mean to both audiences. In fact, this textbook, if it achieves its purpose, will supersede an earlier effort that was done in Israel and Palestine by a group that put the two narratives side by side in a textbook format and left blank space between them. The point being to use the classroom to see whether students could figure out how to deal with the two contrasting narratives. That project was abandoned because students couldn't figure out what to do. So this issue of narratives is as difficult, if not more challenging, than security, Jerusalem, refugees, borders, and so forth. But it is possible in each one of these issues to conceive of a solution in which both sides win. Through what's called Track 2 activities, which are non-official conferences and secret meetings among academics, there are solutions on Jerusalem which are very far-reaching and which have already been integrated into some of the diplomacy. In similar activities on refugees, there are solutions that have also begun to be integrated into the formal, what's called transfer. You transfer what you did in the informal track to the formal track. In other words, to sum all of this up in one word, it's doable. In my view, however, there are two requirements that will determine whether the doability actually gets done. And this is, in my view, the challenge that lies ahead for our Secretary of State and our President. Israelis and Palestinians entered this latest round of negotiations with no terms of reference. In other words, there was no effort to try to get them to agree about what they would be negotiating. Now, again, in your businesses and professions, when you enter into a negotiation, you may not have formal terms of reference, but you kind of know what's on the table. Otherwise, you start with Mars and the other side starts with Venus, and you never quite get close to each other. In negotiations, it's normal in a pre-negotiation process to develop agreed-upon terms of reference, sometimes detailed and sometimes not detailed. There are, to my understanding, no terms of reference that were either agreed or imposed for these parties in the negotiations. One of the great challenges, therefore, one of the two great challenges, therefore, is at what point does the United States either insist upon eliciting agreed terms of reference, which I don't think is doable, or imposes terms of reference? Now, you talk about the word imposition and everybody gets nervous. You're going to impose a solution. How can you do it? The 82nd Airborne is not going in. 101st Airborne can't do it. I'm not talking about imposing a solution. Back in the year 2000, President Bill Clinton put out what he called parameters. It wasn't a plan so much as it was an assessment on the part of the United States President about where the parties had come to in their engagement and where they had narrowed their differences to a point where they should start negotiating within those parameters of difference. Now, for his reasons, President Clinton pulled those parameters off the table when he left office. But surprise of surprises, as soon as he left office, the Palestinians and Israelis went to the Taba area of Egypt and started negotiating on the basis of the Clinton parameters.
because they understood if you walk into a negotiation and the Palestinians start by saying, we want all of Palestine, and the Israelis start by saying, you get no part of Palestine, forget it. And they started using these parameters. Well, here we are, 13 years later. A modified version of those parameters can be developed based on what the two sides have talked about in the interim. And this is not an advertisement for my book, which is available for sale, but this is not an advertisement. I drafted a set of parameters at the end of chapter 12 of the book. They're the Kurtzer parameters. They're no good or no worse than anybody else's, but I did it to suggest that they are doable. So issue number one for the United States as we look forward, and I would suggest that I would even suggest it be used as a bit of a benchmark for all of us to assess American diplomatic behavior, is whether and when the United States feels compelled to put forward parameters as terms of reference for negotiations. Second, the United States since the early 1970s, particularly since the period immediately after the 73 war, has become, both by virtue of what the parties want, but also by virtue of what we want, kind of the sole mediator in the Arab-Israeli conflict. We had a discussion on this with the students. It doesn't necessarily have to be the case, but in fact, it is the case. Washington doesn't like a lot of company and finds it difficult to coordinate policy with the European Union and Russia and the United Nations, and the Chinese have an envoy, and everybody has an envoy. So the United States has become, in some respects, the sole mediator. Now, there are two requirements if you're going to be a sole mediator. One is you're actually going to mediate, which means you're going to find positions between the two sides that are reasonable and fair, and you're going to do your best to move the two sides to get there. And second is you're going to have backbone. You're going to decide that if it's important enough for you to be the mediator, it should be important enough for you to try to actually reach an agreement. Now, the critique that I have offered of American policy, basically since the early 1990s, is that we wanted to be the mediator, but we didn't have the backbone of a mediator. And we would let the parties go at it themselves. They would run into problems. At one point in a book that Dennis Ross wrote on his own experience, he talks about the bicycle analogy. It was important for us to keep the bicycle moving so that it wouldn't tip over and fall if there was a crisis. Respectfully, I'd say that's nonsense, because it depends where the bicycle's going. And if it's heading in the wrong direction, why would you simply want it to keep moving instead of taking stock of where you are and deciding where it should be going? So the second criterion for us to look at as a benchmark for possibility of success or the equal possibility of failure is whether or not the United States gets serious about its role as mediator. As important as the working level negotiations are, we have spoiled the Middle East into believing that only the Secretary of State and ultimately only the President is actually going to consummate a deal. So at what point will John Kerry go back out to the region and start to move back and forth between not the working level negotiators, but between President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? So if I were to stand back and suggest a framework, which I've tried to lay out today, it is that we have a complex and very challenging diplomatic agenda ahead of us. Issues which have direct impact on our national security and on the national security of our friends in the region, especially Israel with respect to the Iranian nuclear issue, that we have manifest in the past the capacity to do hard diplomacy, and that the question for the future is whether we are prepared now to do that same hard diplomacy to bring two relatively unwilling partners to understand that the resolution of their conflict is achievable. If you invite me back, we can assess this year after next or whenever, maybe celebrate the signing of a peace treaty. The point being is that diplomacy can work. but it's got to be tough diplomacy. And I think we as a nation and our leaders are capable of such diplomacy. Thank you very much.
Question is, when do you become Secretary of State?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I will not report that question to my wife, who's very happy now we have time to spend with our grandchildren.
The question I have is one real simple thing. How do you figure the Gaza situation in it? How can a boss negotiate for somebody he doesn't represent? So how can you say you're cutting a deal? It's external of Gaza. And what does it mean when you can't control those people who do a good job of launching rockets?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And the way the Palestinians have thought about it until now, meaning the Palestinian Authority, Abbas and his government, is that they will try to negotiate a framework agreement that would include both the West Bank and Gaza. It would then be subjected to a referendum in which Gaza Palestinians and even diaspora Palestinians would be allowed to cast their vote. And that as a result of that referendum, if it's adopted, then presumably a period of national reconciliation would take place in which Gaza and the West Bank would become a political whole once again. If the referendum were rejected, you don't have a peace treaty anyway. Now, it's a very mechanical way of thinking about this, because for Hamas, for example, there is an existential political question involved. It opposes the idea of the state of Israel, and it's not just a question of wanting 10% more territory or 5% more of this. But interestingly, Hamas has said, and I've seen nothing that changes this, Hamas leaders have said that while they do not support peace negotiations, they will accept the outcome of referendum. Now, I don't know if they will, but that's the part to be tested. And it may be that we go through a very challenging period of negotiations only to see it crumble because of the incapacities of a Palestinian political system. But that's the best we have to offer now, and that's why we're trying.
You answered the second question I was going to ask. Thank you for anticipating.
First of all, thank you for a very, very good presentation. I'd like to separate product from process. Product, of course, is what seek an agreement, peace agreement, peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Usually that's within the context of two states for two peoples. And the process leading to that, I assume, is designed to lead to that outcome. My question is this. It becomes increasingly possible that a two-state solution is unattainable, because the two-state solution is based on, essentially focuses on the 67 problems. And what is the reality is the 47 problems might be even more important and the more difficult to resolve. Not even Falk deals with that. Question is this. Is there serious work being done on alternatives that would be acceptable to both sides? I know the Jordanian option has been in the draw since right. Forever. Is there serious work being done on looking for alternatives to what we now would generally consider dividing the territory into two states?
There's a variety of ways to look at that question, which is a good question. First of all, diplomats will not be doing serious work on the alternative to the process in which they are engaged and focused. They just won't do it. So all this talk about, you know, let's start planning for a plan B, we can do that in academia. Diplomats are not going to do that. Because once the word would get out that they're even thinking about plan B, forget about plan A. Number one. Number two, my view, this is now me, is that it is theoretically possible that a two-state solution is not a realizable outcome. I won't be convinced until at least one of those two benchmarks that I cited in my remarks
is actually happens, and that is we get serious. If I see a process in which the Secretary of State, the President, have given all, they're ready to enter into persuasion. I hate the word pressure. But they're ready to pressure Israelis and Palestinians toward reasonable middle ground. And if it then fails where the serious effort has been made, I'm with you. Then we have to go to Plan B. Third way to look at it. I teach policy workshops at Princeton, at the graduate level, the undergraduate level, and they're very interesting because you not only teach subject matter, but then you turn around and say to the students, okay, now what are you going to do with this? You're now policymakers. And they actually have to brief their outcomes to Washington policymakers. It's a really, really good course. We did our workshop last fall on the question, are there alternatives to the two-state solution? Now, diplomats can't do that, but I can. I'm now in academia. The students came in and immediately said to me, if you think that we're in this class to help you prove that there's only a two-state solution, you're wrong. We are going to try to prove that there are alternatives to the two-state solution. And I was thrilled because that's exactly what I wanted them to do. I wanted them to take this seriously enough that they would examine as many alternatives as possible, and they did. Not only examine them through books, but we went to the region, to Palestine and Israel. They did 70 interviews on both sides, and their conclusion was there are a lot of theoretical alternatives. None of them works. For a variety of reasons. It may be one side would say no, the other side would say no, both sides. There's a lot of reasons why they don't work, but the conclusion was, in an honest evaluation by very smart graduate students, there really isn't an alternative. So, A, let's really give it a shot. If that fails, I'll work with you on Plan B, but I think my students have told us it's going to be hard to make a convincing case that there really is a Plan B.
That third thing, by the way, is good news.
Yeah.
The most unpleasant part of my job is I have to end things when I know that there are more people who have questions and comments. So I'd like you to join me now in thanking Ambassador Kurtzer for this wonderful, stimulating presentation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.